This time on the show, you have to live in the story before you can live in the world.
There are no empty silences.
And get the reader to go where you want them to go. All this and more on Comics Are Great. It's Comics Are Great, the visual storytelling show, recorded live every other Wednesday at the Ann Arbor District Library in lovely, gorgeous, tranquil, but also exciting Ann Arbor, Michigan. Comics.aadl.org, and this is the show where we talk about making comics, creating characters, worlds people believe in, writing stories visually, and also the lifestyle of a cartoonist. All the stuff that surrounds this medium that drives us all mad. My name is Jersey Droz, cartoonist and teaching artist. And I guess we might want to call this one BDs Are Great, because my guest is Nicholas Bannister, or just Bannister.
Hi.
Calling Jersey. All the way from France.
That's right.
And what time is it there right now?
It's 6:30 p.m.
Oh, okay. I thought it was...
So,
oh, my calculations
it's,
were
six more hours than you. So it's almost dinner time.
So you're 2 hours away from Greenwich Mean Time. I was looking into the different time zones.
That's
and,
right.
Okay. So, but yes, of facebook.com/Nicholas.Bannister and the author or the artist of the Elsewhere Chronicles. And contributor to almost every Flight anthology?
Yeah, every single one of them except the first one.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's seven, actually.
But that's so that you can't miss your work.
No.
And then
it's unmissable.
And then Tib and Tum Tum, which is coming out in October or November, right. in the near future, the autumn of 2013, Tib and Tum Tum comes out, and then also the upcoming book Exodus. You've done a lot of stuff, and as I hinted, you are from France, where people actually appreciate comics.
Yeah, I'm trying to be a bit diversified about what I do because, it's always tough to make a book. I mean, you make your book, it's like 7, maybe 8 months of work. After that, you're just like dry and you don't want to hear about it anymore. And unless you are super, super strong, but that's not my case. And I need to go get some fresh air to come back stronger after a while. So for that, I chose to do several series at the same time. So of course it's a bit time consuming, and I've got to schedule my stuff pretty well because I'm working with several writers and publishers, so it's a bit complicated sometimes. But I mean, I need to do that to go to different places to come back fresh.
So working on different kinds of stories helps keep you fresh and limber.
Yeah.
Also, we will talk about this later on in the show. You also design really amazing posters, the iconic footwear in movies and TV, the Pole Position piece that you did recently. We'll talk about that a little bit in a little bit, and we'll talk more about, because we're going to talk a lot about Elsewhere Chronicles today, because as I told you in the email, by the way, before we dive into the actual topic, I wanted to know, you said there's a story behind the name Bannister.
Oh yeah, that's the name. I was 10 years ago when I started making comics. I didn't want to use my real name, and so I was looking for a pseudonym. I mean, a working name, a pen name, and at the time I was working with my former girlfriend, which is now my wife. We were working on a Ghost Hunters story, and we were watching Frighteners from Peter Jackson with Michael J. Fox. And the main character in Frighteners is named Frank Bannister, if I'm right. And that's where I picked up my pen name, actually. Just stole it from the movie. it's a movie I like, and we were really in that mood at the time, so it's great. And I needed some name that could be pronounced internationally with not too many mistakes to be made.
That is a good idea. That is a really good idea, and I wish I would have thought of that. Because, yeah, my name has been anglicized to Jersey, but it's actually pronounced Yezha, but no one can say that unless they're from Eastern Europe. So,
yeah,
so I'm stuck with Jersey, but if I had a little bit more foresight, I would have come up with a... So, why didn't you want to go by your real name? Is there any reason behind that, or is that just common practice to use?
It's like super complicated with letters that are really not really well pronounceable in English, mostly because it's the main language I use aside the French, and it's a bit complicated to say. So it will be like torn apart and misspelled like all the time.
Right. Right. The reason I finally decided that Jersey's fine, just call me Jersey, because I got so tired of hearing people go, Yaji? Yiju? Yeah. No, just Jersey. That just works. It's fine. I don't care anymore.
It's just super tiring in the end to rectify people all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That makes perfect sense. So, okay. So I sent an email to you. It was like, you know, the way I like to do the show is I like to bring a guest on and look at their work and find what jumps out at me as this is the thing that they do better than anybody else. And and when I was reading the Elsewhere Chronicles, I was blown away by your design, the character design, environment design, just fantastic. And then also your compositions. I mean, especially like I was telling you before we started recording, book 5 of the Elsewhere Chronicles, oh my gosh, something happened, and all the shots are just amazing in that book. But I've got examples through all the first 5 books that we can talk about today. But I want to start with fantasy design, and especially because you're in pre-production on this new book, Exodus, which comes out next year, and you've been posting on your Facebook page explorations, tests, and examinations of designing an environment. And I can just use Elsewhere Chronicles as an example. Is like the thing I noticed is all of your fantasy environments, shape plays a vital role. You use very elegant and simple shapes, deceptively simple shapes, where a rock face or a wall would be rendered almost entirely in squares, which seems counterintuitive, like, well, rocks aren't shaped like squares, but it looks right in your world. And then you have this tree that's like made of like winding tubes, almost looks like.
Yeah,
you know the one I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know the one. Yeah,
it's in book 5. It's on page
43,
and it looks like these winding tubes. I didn't pull this one up, Matt, as an example, so I'll just put it on the camera here. But yeah, so I'm just curious, like, so when you're getting script from a writer or notes from a writer or a premise, how do you, like, one of the things you said before we started recording was making it look simple is so hard. Like, what is the decision-making process in creating a world that feels like it belongs to itself?
Usually I read when I get the script, I read it twice. First time, just to enjoy the story and see if it flows and if it's good, and that's it. And the second time, I try to picture things. And the things I picture usually are the most efficient ones are the first one I picture. I'm not trying to go beyond my first vision or my first impression. I mean, I just sketch very simple things, like the square rocks or the giant tree, like made from vines and stuff. And it's just very, very small and quick visions I've got when I read that the script. And then I elaborate a little bit around that. I try to find different ways to picture it the way I want. And but I try to keep it simple, but the key to keep it simple is to work hard on it. I mean, it's there is nothing that flows, that is very fluid, that is very obvious, that you can do without a great amount of work before that. I mean, on that, it's just the paradox of creation. I mean, you've got the same thing Let's take, for instance, the Pixar movie, because they are like a reference in the business. And you've got those movies, they seem to be like very simple stories, and they are very obvious, and they are, they don't seem very complicated, but they are really well polished, and they are clean, and the cogs works perfectly all together. But this requires an amount of work that is just insane. I mean, you've got to define your story, and you've got to explore any way possible to tell the right thing at the right time, the right way. And it's very complicated, and you've got to do that in art as well when you design a world or a universe.
Yeah.
And basically, that's the premise of working on a, on a, on a fantasy book for me, actually. And after that, you've got some ideas. You don't even know where they come from, and you just go with it because it's a cool idea. And it's just like the, oh, let's do square rocks because I haven't seen that in a book before.
Right.
Let's try if it works. And whoa, it works. So yeah, let's keep it. and I use it, and it works because most of the time, which works right are the contrasts. Like, for instance, my characters, they are a bit, they are round shaped, they are cartoony, and putting them in a very square environment, it works even more. I mean, you've got that contrast that makes a balance in that universe.
Now that I think about that, yeah, there's a scene where the characters fall into a pit, and you have all of these smooth-shaped characters, and the pit is rendered entirely in triangles and squares, right? And they're all warm colors, and the background is all cool colors, right? So you have that contrast there.
Yeah, they are easy things to put on. I mean, they're not easy visuals to do, but they are. We know this is a recipe that works. I mean, when you do contrast of that. Like that. It's something you will see when you notice it. You will see that like everywhere, in the books that are appealing, very appealing to you. They are very, everybody's using the same recipes, so they are not using it the same way as I do, which is interesting because that's what makes us different, and some people are more inclined to like that kind of style or that kind of style, but usually you try to do pretty much the same thing.
Do you make an effort to be observant of these contrasts in your day-to-day life? Because I'll tell you, one of the things I teach comics classes, and one of the things that I find my students have a real hard time with is when they're designing something, they're so hung up on the drawing part and drawing it correctly that they don't think about the design element. They're just trying to draw something well. And so I created an exercise where I said, take your digital cameras, go for a walk. Every time you see something that makes you say, cool or neat, don't overthink it. Just grab a picture of it. And then the next class, we put the pictures all out and we examine them to see what is attracting their eye. Now you have a sense of where your design sensibilities fall. And I had students noticing things like, hey, you know what I picked up? I went for a walk at night, and the street lamp had an orangish color, and the shadow from the tree had a purplish color. And I was like, ah, you just discovered color contrast and the way light creates opposite colors in its shadows, you know? If I asked them to draw that, they would be stuck on drawing it well. But by making them go out and observe before they draw, suddenly their work improved. I mean, is this something that you train yourself to do, is to be observant of those kinds of things?
I try to, but I'm not very good at colors, for starters. So which is like kind of a handicap for me. I'm not very good at that. I'm okay at drawings and maybe designs too, but colors, it's not my style. So it's not my thing. And so, that's why I've got a colorist most of the time, which... I mean, who does wonderful job on the Elsewhere Chronicles?
And, absolutely.
But those are the kind of things you've got to be attentive to. But you know, when you, I don't notice it anymore. I mean, I used to try to notice that in the street and everywhere. And right now, it's just part of my job. So it's it's really part of me. So I don't notice that kind of stuff. But you've got to be the thing is more importantly, the thing is you've got to be behind a camera screen to notice that. It's got to be framed. I mean, it's got to be framed and in 2D. And I've got all the pain to notice that without that interface between the world and me. Mm-hmm. So I can see amazing things in real life, but if it's not like on screen and in 2D, I will have some troubles to see the shapes and what's very powerful and the contrast and stuff like that. So it's a bit complicated to explain, but it's got to be translated on a flat screen to be noticed by me. But that's why I always carry a camera with me. I mean, most of the time I try to carry a camera and take a lot of pictures of everything.
I noticed that in your environment designs for Exodus, you were using photography. You were using photos of real environments, and then you were making drawings from those. So you post the photo with a drawing of the character in there, and then the next post that you do is now the background is a complete drawing, and then you start adding color and different effects, and we watch this thing grow, and it was so cool to see that you actually work from photography first. That's something that I showed my students, saying, see, this is how the French do it, and they make the best comics, so let's copy that, please.
Yeah, you can do. I mean, you can use pretty much whatever you want to obtain the results you are looking for. And as long as it's legal and not stealing others' property. But right. For Exodus, I'm not good at backgrounds. I'm not good at perspective. I'm not good at drawing houses and cars and everything that's solid and man-made.
I don't buy that for a second. That is a bold-faced lie.
And the thing is, being not good at that, I've got to find a way to render the things if I want to do them myself. So I decided to take to go from pictures, which is a good way to work as well. The thing is, the story is set in New York, so I had to go to New York, which is a nice excuse to go visit New York, actually. But it ended up being a very nice study trip, because we noticed things that we wouldn't have noticed if we weren't been there. And to take some reference pictures. And yeah, I took a lot of pictures. I took like 4,000 pictures in New York in 10 days to get all the references I needed for my backgrounds.
Wow.
But it was very useful. And now I've got to process them and to see which ones are useful for the books or not. I've got to read the scripts for that. And because I anticipated on the script, so I had to imagine what the things, what shots I would need and stuff like that. So like pretty much like a movie director, you know. And I decided to shoot a lot of pictures and then to use them to as a background and to redraw them. And to add some sci-fi elements in them, so we know it's New York, and you know it's sci-fi, but it's not really the New York you know, because you modify it, which is also very interesting in a way.
Well, it blends the familiar with the unfamiliar, right? Mm. To ground the story somewhat, because I noticed this with your creature designs as well, is they're just familiar enough that I know what it is, but it's just it's alien enough or different enough that it feels frightening. With the monsters,
it's one of the key. It's one key of fantasy or sci-fi design. I mean, you just take something that exists on Earth and you modify it a little bit, which would be like size or maybe like the head or something. Like you take Avatar, for instance. All the creatures in Avatar, they are pretty much the same as we've got here, except they are all shiny and they've got six legs. And that's pretty much it. And you've got the sci-fi creatures.
Yeah.
And that's it. And I did the same in my in my books, and everybody does the same. You just take like a panda, and you add a tail or big ears, and you've got an alien creature. Mm-hmm. And for the Elsewhere Chronicles, I do that. I mean, if I want a big monster that is very disgusting, I take a slug and I multiply the size by like 20, 50. I don't care. It's sci-fi. It's fantasy, so I can do pretty much what I want.
Right.
It's all a matter of scale as well. Mm-hmm. If you want to make it epic, it's not complicated. I mean, you want an epic shot, it's not complicated at all. You just go into the forest, you take a picture of the forest, and then you draw a very small character on it, and you've got the giant tree forest, and it's done.
Right.
it's kind of easy. After that, you've got to include that in a story, in a way that works, in a way that's easy to read for the reader, and it's got to be useful to the story as well.
All right. So now we get to what I like to call a squishy question. You said it has to be right for the story. How do you know? I designed a cool monster. I made a thing that has a shark head with a mouse's body and bat wings. It's the coolest thing ever. How do I know whether or not it is appropriate for this story?
Because that's the story will guide you. The script you will read, the story you've got to illustrate is your guide. And you immediately know if your design is good or not. I mean, it's just... I would say it's obvious. I mean, you don't do as long as you've got a goal and you know what you are doing and where you're going. You cannot do anything you want. You've got like a rail, and it's just like the story tells you to draw a horse that has got like eight legs. You can do that, but you cannot go in every direction possible, because you know that there will be consequences after that. And if you do whatever you like, at one point you will have to pay for that, because you will have to deal with the choices you made before. And you've got the creatures you are creating, and you will have to deal with them for the world book, if not the world series. And then they've got to be consistent and constant all that long, and they've got to serve the story as well. The key is the story. I mean, you are working for the story. You're not working to show off your skills at a creature designer.
Mm-hmm. In other words, we take Elsewhere Chronicles, right? A book for what's the age range that this is for?
I think it's starting from 8 or 9 or something.
Okay, 8 or 9 year olds. Yeah. And if I say to you, Bannister, I got this great idea for a character for Elsewhere Chronicles, for like the final book. It's this guy who carries around a bunch of half-decomposed severed heads on his chest. And he drinks the blood of infants in front of other people. And he's got needles coming out of his eye sockets. What do you think? Great, great character for the story, right?
Yeah, but I mean, what's his background? What is he gonna do in the story? Why? How will he interfere with the characters? And knowing that, I will know how to design it pretty much easily. It's gonna be easy, because you don't know, will they have to fight or not? If they do, I will need a weapon. And if I don't need a weapon, what is it? Is it a magician or something? A wizard? So I need infos to create my character. And of course, yeah, he's got like the severed head on the scarf or anything. It's great. But I won't design it the same way if it's for the Elsewhere Chronicles or if it's for a super hardcore fantasy book for adults. Mm-hmm. Because it's gonna be like, you know, it's very different. You cannot do the same thing. I mean, you don't design. It doesn't work for zombies, because zombies, they're pretty much the same in the Elsewhere Chronicles or in Walking Dead, basically. Because zombies, they are zombies. Any story you read. But you've got to have a purpose for all these designs and characters and a story behind it, and it always comes back to the story and where you want to go and what you want to tell. And after that, you can design the thing you want, but you just need to serve the story.
Mm. So it does, story informs a lot of these choices and really understanding the story. And sometimes that understanding of the story is an intuition thing, right? You know when you get it, right? So maybe like you were describing reading through the script or the notes several times until you feel like you understand it is part of that process, maybe. I want to make sure we have time to talk about composition. We got a lot of stuff to talk about there. But so we should talk about... Take a break between talking philosophy, and let's talk about the 80s for a second. Let's talk about these posters you did. What were they called? This was
iconic movie shoes posters. I think something like that. I don't really have a name for that, but yeah. So
the iconic footwear in movies and TV.
That's right.
And you did, actually, the Doctor Who poster is right behind you in the studio.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I printed it just for a test, and it looks great in big, so I'm gonna do several of them, I guess.
Eric's posting the link in the chat, and it's tuxboard.com/posters. Oh, man, I can't pronounce all these words. But tuxboard.com is where you can find it. But you can also find it on Bannister's Google Plus feed and on his Facebook page. But where did this come from? Like, who sits down and says, you know what? I want to draw shoes for famous characters.
The thing is, I like shoes. I like sneakers mostly, but I like shoes overall. And I've got lots of pair of shoes, and my wife is not happy about that, but that's the way it is. I'm not into collecting things or into buying stuff a lot, but yeah, shoes, it's like my weak spot. So every time I see a nice pair of shoes, I try to restrain myself, but it doesn't last long. Anyway.
Knowing this, I have to ask this question. What is an excellent pair of shoes for cartoonists?
Oh, wow. the Star Wars collection from Adidas.
Really?
Nice. Yeah. It's pretty cool. I've got three myself, and I wear them in festivals and stuff like that. And what else did I get lately? Converse did a lot of DC shoes and Batman, Superman, and superhero shoes, but they are not, they are a bit too pop for me. Mm-hmm. And
the Chuck Taylors, I can't wear them anymore. I'm too old now. They hurt my feet. I need something with actual arch support, you know? So comfort is important to me, at least. So, but you were saying, sorry.
Yeah. They're pretty nice. I mean, they are... a lot of brands, they try to do movie shoes, and you've got shoes that goes into movies, like the Reebok just designed the Aliens shoes, the Stompers, which are very nice too. But my brother has got a pair of them, but when you wear them in real life, it just looks a bit weird. It's fun when you know what it is, but if you don't know what it is, just like wearing, I mean, like snow boots or something. It's weird, but it's very cool. In a convention, it's perfect. And so I like those items. And for a long time, I wouldn't know what to do with that thing of mine. And all of a sudden, I decided to do illustrations about shoes in movies, because I wanted people to know what were the shoes, I mean, the iconic shoes, not all the shoes in movies, but the iconic ones that everybody knows about. I wanted people to know what were the names and the brands of those shoes. So I made some research, and for most of them, I found what I needed. And it was pretty fun. And so there are movies I like and shoes I like, so yeah. Let's do that. And it appears I ended up with like 11 shoes, and I needed a 12th one just to make it round and finish.
For the folks who are just listening to the audio or who haven't seen these posters yet, the posters are just the characters' lower legs and feet in the top third of the poster, and then it's more of a color wash that comes down towards the bottom and then with the character's name. And they're really striking posters, and they got some traction. They got passed around by quite a few people. And I just thought it was so cool that here's another example of how the internet works. You like a thing, so you like shoes a lot. And then you say, you know what? I want to draw shoes. I'm going to draw some shoes. And then you make a lot of people happy.
That's right. And it's a good example. I mean, the composition of the posters as well, because I was focusing only on the shoes. So I didn't need the wall character. So I just draw the lower part of the legs, and I let it breathe a lot under it before adding the name at the bottom of the poster, because I didn't want to overload it too much visually. I wanted to keep simple, still with some textures and some grain, but I didn't want to put too much details into them, because I wanted them to be posters you could hang on your wall in your kitchen or your living room or your studio or whatever, but not to be too much annoyed or tired visually by them.
Oh, that is a great, great term. You don't want people to become tired visually or visually wear them out, right?
Yeah.
That makes a lot of things click in my head when I'm reading the Elsewhere Chronicles, because so much of it is deceptively simple. But it's never so busy that I get lost in the page. It's very clear. It's absolutely clear. But anyway, people should go check out those poster designs. I think they're really great. And then you also did a pole position piece recently that made me very happy as a big fan of that show.
Yeah, I was a big fan of it when I was a kid. But the show in itself wasn't that good, but the concept was amazing.
Yep.
I mean, the stories, they are pretty hard to follow right now as adults, and even kids right now. I don't know if they could follow that. But yeah, the concept of those flying cars and the team and stuff, the 80s were all about vehicles and teams. And it is one of them. And once again, it's contrast. I mean, you've got the boy and the girl, and you've got that old car and that very brand new car, which actually kind of sucks because they didn't put a real brand on it. It's not a real car that does exist. I mean, because at the time, the futuristic cars that didn't exist yet, of course. But still, it's still a matter of contrast, just like we talked like earlier.
Yep.
And it works.
And the contrast between the personalities of the two talking cars, right?
As well.
Yeah, absolutely. All the way down, there's contrast. It's funny. You may have heard of this amazing cartoonist named Tony Cliff.
Of course.
He was on the show.
Amazing.
Oh God, yeah. I'm beginning to suspect he's not human. But he was on the show a couple episodes ago, and one of the things that we talked about was characters, and he wrote this great article about how supposed to be about how to write strong female characters. And then as he wound his way through the article, he was like, I guess what I'm really talking about is contrast. You want lots of contrast between your characters.
That's
and
right.
You want contrast in everything in your book, because that's what makes the difference. By showing the differences, you show what makes the thing work, right? Okay. We got to talk about composition on this show. And I've got some examples of your work to put on the air. I just had a discussion yesterday. I was in class, and I was telling my students, I gave them an assignment, and I said, you're going to make a comic, there's going to be two panels in every page. Why there are two panels? Because we want contrast. We want to see which one's bigger, which one's smaller, and why. But then I said, you also must have a character, a background, you must have dialogue. And one of the students very cleverly raised his hand and said, comics don't have to have dialogue. And I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, well, I read a comic that had no word balloons at all. And I said, but how did you know what was happening in the story? And he said, well, the characters did this and this and this. And then we had a discussion. Is that dialogue? Well, it's communicating meaning visually. That's dialogue, right? And it made me think about the show we were going to do today, about how the moments you choose, the shots you take, or the shots you draw, communicate story. And if you don't think about that, you're missing an opportunity to really dig deep and explore, some interesting story. I want to pull up a page from, let's see, which page did I have here that I wanted to use? I want to say book 5, page 28. Yeah.
28.
Yeah, book 5, page 28. Matt, you got that one pulled up?
Right.
Yeah, and so, spoiler alert, a character apparently dies in this book. I say apparently because I trust that you guys are going to reveal more information than that. Although, Elsewhere Chronicles, for a book for little kids, does have quite a bit of death in it, but very tastefully
done.
Yes, it does. But here are the characters reflecting on the moment. And look at this wonderful depth of field that you have here. Again, it's got the round characters with the soft round scene below of where the character just died, but then they're surrounded by all of these angles, the square rocks, this giant triangle jutting out, but giving us this moment of silence, but also giving it to us in a visual way. And I wrote down, like, okay, what are the three things that Nicholas is, or Bannister is doing in this story with composition? Is he's evoking tone, information, and visual interest in all of these shots. So I'm wondering, like, when you're doing these kind of shots, what are you thinking about? I mean, is this the kind of thing where you just kind of visualize it and like, yeah, that sounds right, I'm just intuiting it? Or is it something where you're doing lots of different angles on these shots to get to this?
I think on this one, I did several takes. This one worked the most, obviously. That's why I chose it. But yes, you can deduce a lot of things on this panel. You've got the trail from the monster that just killed the character, and you've got surrounded by some very aggressive shapes. So, you know, it's a pretty, hostile world. And you've got the front character who is packing for what's going to be like a trip, of course, because we are on a road trip here, on a journey. And you've got those two characters who are very tired and sad, and they are looking to the horizon where their friend disappeared. And that's also the direction in which they will be going, like the page after or two pages after. So you've got a lot of information in that. And that you get, you get that from the early on from the reading of the script, because it's all written in the script. I mean, when you read the story, there is no other choice than doing that kind of shot. I mean, it's just obvious. I mean, you've got to show that. Will it be in one panel or two panels? But I decided to do it on one, just to show a bit of the scope of the scene, of where it happened. And it's kind of a transition moments, and you've got to let it breathe, so there is not too much details, so you can just dive into it. I mean, visually, and your eyes can breathe in the background, and it leads you slowly to the next panels. And actually, the next one, the next panel is also it's a close up on the character who is mourning, but he's by himself because is much more of a lone wolf in that case. And then you start the story again. But you've got to pause the story for that. And you've got to, of course, put no dialogues and just, it's just like, two morning panels, basically.
There are no empty silences in this book, though. I mean, even though this is a silent moment, it is loaded with meaning, right?
Mm-mm. Yeah. Everything, we only have 46 pages to tell our story, so we cannot waste a single panel. It's just not possible. You've got everything is well thought, to use the properly the most space as possible, and to put the more information as we can on the pages. But at the same time, we don't want to overload it, so we've got to restrain ourselves from putting too much information. And but everything is thought. I mean, in the third panel of the page, you've got the three characters speaking, and the last one is very lost in the back of it, and is still in contemplation, in mourn. actually, and he's not coming back before a little bit of time. But the other ones already are ready to go, but he's not yet. Right. And you've got to show that.
Yep. I've got another page that I want to pull up. This is book four, page 43. And 43. Before we show it, Matt, I want to describe the scene to the viewers and listeners, and we'll see what pictures they get in their head. And then we'll show what Bannister does with this. Because this is really interesting. This is a fantastic example of that kind of condensation of information, which is deceptively simple. It appears to be simple, but it isn't. Okay, so two characters. You got an old man and a young guy riding along on a motorcycle through a rocky desert landscape, right? And they're talking to each other as they're racing along. And they're going really fast because they're trying to get to help some friends. And, you know, they're saying, like, oh, don't worry about her, Rebecca. She's just a ghost. All that better that she disappeared into thin air. Noah, why are you so mean? Actually, these are some other characters who are talking they're talking in a cave nearby where the two characters are speeding along, right? So we're listening to a conversation of characters in a cave while two characters are speeding along in this desert landscape. And they're driving along really fast. And we also see a dog that is growling, that is behaving in a way that isn't quite natural. And then we finally hear the old man and the boy talking. Hey, kids, slow down before you chuck us over the edge, because they're driving along a cliff. Don't worry, I've got this under control. And then the old man says, at the same time, or all the same, slow down or I'll toss your rear right out of here. And we hear the motorcycle engine roaring. And then the boy says, but you said they were in danger. We have to catch up with them. Okay, so hopefully that painted some kind of a picture in your head. Now let's look at the page. Matt, can we pull it up? And what I love about this is that we're listening to that conversation in the cave while we're seeing just the environment and the characters speeding. We don't even see the characters in the motorcycle. All we see is the smoke up on the cliffside. And then we get a little bit closer, and we see the characters in the motorcycle. Now, when I started this description, I said we see two characters in a motorcycle. But I would instinctively draw just the characters in the motorcycle, right? But you take your time to back up and show the environment and the incoming threats of the thing speeding along the ground, that sand whale, and we see the smoke moving along the cliffside, slowly closing into the characters, right?
Yeah, it's a build-up page. I mean, you are increasing the tension. It's a zoom. You are zooming into the characters, and I took the whole page to do that because I needed some. The text is very strong, and you've got to not to be redundant visually, graphically, with the text. So you've got to tell something else, but still it's got to be in relation with that text. Right. And it was a good moment to show the environment, the neighborhood of that place, which is very, very scary. And at the same time, they are coming from very far, so you've got to wait for them to come to destination. So you have to show that as well. So that's why you see them from very far, just like that little dust cloud behind them, very far away, and we zoom on them, and we end on a close up with like some kind of a punchline or a catchphrase that I don't know really the term, and in between, I put the dog because the dog is the closest witness of what's happening. It's been shown before. It's been shown in the first panel and on the previous pages. And we know the dog is with the characters who are right now in danger. Mm-hmm. But I cannot show the characters in danger because I will spoil the word tension and everything will fall apart. So I just show the dogs seeing. I'm doing my Steven Spielberg that way. I mean, that's what he's doing all the time. I mean, he's just showing people looking at scary stuff, but he's not showing you scary stuff. He's just showing the fear
right
in the eyes of the characters.
Yeah.
With that low angle traveling and stuff. He's very good for that. And it's the same thing in his movie, War of the World, where you can see an attack of the monsters behind a hill, but you don't see the attack at all. You just see the army shooting at the monsters, and the witnesses just looking at it, like just amazed by what's going on. This is the same thing. I mean, you just trust the reader and the imagination of the reader by just showing a result of what's happening, but it's off screen.
Yeah, as we're the other thing I was going to point out was in panel one, you did this really nice thing where you just put this rock in the foreground on the left. Mm-hmm. And that simple addition, it's a simple shape, but boom, we have a sense of scale here. We have a sense of dimension and depth in that shot too, which also kind of heightens the tension because there is an enormous distance these characters have to cover before they get to their friends, right? Mm-hmm. And we've shown you very simply in one panel while other characters are talking, right? It's a great example of using composition effectively. But I love this idea also, of making sure that, I guess what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, you have to have a deep understanding about what, not only what the story is about, but what every scene is about in order to pick a good composition for the shot, right?
Yeah.
Like what's...
You've got to know pretty much everything about everything in your story. And, I mean, what's going on, what happened before, what's going on right now, and what's going to happen next. So you can try to put the best out of you to make the best shot possible. And in that particular case, for the first panel, I mean, you've got that foreground, and the foreground is essential. You always need a foreground if you want to add a sense of scale, some depth. You need a foreground that is very present. Would it be in the shadow or right, like here, like lit by the sun?
Yeah.
And you need that. And it's it's some things like this. They are, I wouldn't say they are obvious to me, but I don't think about them that much. I mean, they are common sense. For me, you know,
sure.
And they are the result of everything I've watched and read during these past 35 years. So it's something that this is something that works. So I don't see why I would try to do it differently. And if I would, it wouldn't work.
Right.
So it's
when you draw enough pages, this is another thing that like I get asked every once in a while, like, oh, how do I become a graphic novelist or a BD artist or a comics artist, and it sucks to say it, but it really does boil down to make a lot of comics because this will become an apparent language to you. How do you? Okay, you're talking in your second language right now to me, right? And you're doing it very well. But when you're talking in French, I bet you don't have to think about it as much when you're talking in French, right?
Yeah.
Because it's your natural language, and when you spend time with it, like that's like asking somebody, like, how do I learn to speak German? Speak German a lot, you know. Read stuff.
Just practice. there is no magic trick or anything. No easy solution. You've got to practice.
Right.
That's it. I mean, some people are a little bit more gifted than others. I mean, they've got that little spark. Some doesn't have maybe, but I guess like with work, anybody can get somewhere.
Right.
And I mean, for comics, for music, for anything, you've got to practice. If you don't practice, you won't get nowhere. It doesn't come from nothing.
Right. You know? I took 2 years of German in high school, and I used to be able to speak German very, very well, almost fluently. And I can't even remember. I can remember how to say, where's the toilet now?
It's the same for me. I took 6 years of German in high school as well, and I don't know anything left.
Yes, you didn't use it. You don't use it every day, right? And when you use it every day, you stay in practice and fluid. Okay, I got one more example I want to cover, and I know Sharon Iverson is in the building, ready to do some book recommendations, but I got one more example. This is book one, page five. Book one, the fifth page, and... Okay, I'm going to do the same thing again I did before. I'll do it very quickly for the listeners and viewers. I'm going to describe the scene. So you have some kids watching a funeral, and there's three boys hanging out on the periphery of the cemetery, and a little girl who was at the funeral with her family comes walking up to the boys to talk to them. And they go through their introductions, and as they're going through their introductions, the little girl explains that, oh, those guys, those people over there that I'm with, that's my family, and the guy who they're burying is my grandfather. So there's a little bit of information to get across here, and you managed to get through this in, what, five panels? The last five panels of the page. We can pull it up now, Matt. We cover all this ground, but in a way that is visually interesting and also very elegant, because when Rebecca points to her family to say, oh, yeah, I'm with those guys over there, and then you close in on the dad who waves and smiles friendly, it feels like a natural progression because we're peering through that hole that you created with the character's legs and the hole in the wall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's... once again, I'm just illustrating what I saw when I read the script. And it's, I mean, in the end, we talk about the dad, so I got to show him. It's the first time we show him for real, basically, because, yeah, I mean, no, we saw him like the page before, but this time he's interacting with the characters, so it's got to be a close-up. And that first panel, when she's going toward them, I mean, it's, you've got... as well, a lot of information. I mean, you know she's going backward because she's going towards the left of the panel, mm-hmm. and we saw her back, so we are obviously following her towards those little boys in the back. And I added some that little house, that shed in the end of the cemetery to show it's the very back of it. Mm-hmm. It's very far away, and that's it. And then after that, they talk. Each other, they talk to each other and they interact, and you've got to vary your shots so it doesn't look that like they are all, I mean, talking heads. You've got to vary your shots so people don't get bored by reading the thing, and it's like you are in the middle of the conversation, and you are looking at one character, then the other one who is answering. And after that, you've got to use directing effects to get the reader where you want him and where you want them to get. I mean, it's by taking that shot on the before last panel, the almost last panel. It's like a visor. I mean, you're just like aiming at those group of characters. Mm-hmm. Basically, you've got the round shape, and you've got the girl looking towards them. So you are obviously looking with her towards them. And then after that, you see the father in close shot, which is once again just like the obvious way to do it for me. But it seems very very easy, you know, at the time to do that.
Sure, but this is the kind of thing that a lot of beginning cartoonists will lose sight of, is they might show a close up of Rebecca and show her pointing mm-hmm. off panel, and then the next panel is a close up of the dad waving without any sense of space or blocking and without intellectually guiding us to the next thing that we're going to see, right?
That's right. And after that, it's also a matter of sensibilities. I mean, I love storytelling, and I love when the panels, they are flowing very fluently, yeah. One after each other, so you don't have to fight. I mean, the worst thing I want to do when I read a comic book is to fight against it. And I don't want to try and understand what's going on. I mean, it's got to be obvious. It's got to be very fluent and fluid. It's got to, yeah, to flow very easily. And you just don't think about what you read. You're just in it. And I'm trying to give that sensation to the reader that is in the story. And at no point I've got to take him out by making a mistake of with the wrong shot or storytelling or showing off for whatever reason. So it's just a matter of serving the story the better way possible.
One of the things I'm hearing in all of our discussions today is you have to live in the story before you can live in the world, right?
Oh yeah, you do. Yeah. You completely do. I mean, when I'm drawing my pages, I'm completely with the characters. So I'm way more involved emotionally than the readers will be, because I'm spending way more time with them than you guys are while reading the book. But still, when I'm doing that, I'm completely taking the readers with me, and I'm hoping that at least they will get a little bit of what I'm living when I'm drawing it. You know.
Yeah. Can you believe we've been talking for an hour already?
Yeah, no. Already? Wow.
That went so fast.
Yeah, absolutely.
The show goes so fast. So we've got to do book recommendations, but I want to give you a final word before we move on to talking about books, Bannister. Any final thoughts on this composition thing? I think you summed it up really well.
I mean, go for the easiest shot, the obvious one. I mean, don't try to do something just to impress people. Just try to tell your story the best way possible and the easy way possible, and you will get your effects all the time. I mean, most of the books that are classics now, they are very simple and obvious in storytelling and shot choices.
That is so good. That is so good. All right. So, okay. Well, I told you that we were going to be doing book recommendations. I don't know if you picked any. I see Sharon Iverson has an enormous pile.
I've got, what do I have?
Okay, I'll let you organize your books while we let Sharon do her book recommendations
sure.
first.
So. I'm ready when you are.
All right. Awesome. So, Sharon Iverson, comics.aadl.org. So good to have you back. It's been a while. Is your mic on?
Is my mic on?
It is
it
now.
It is now.
There we go.
Okay.
All right. So.
Hi,
so,
Sharon.
Hi, Bannister. You know, I want to thank you for being on the show here because I haven't read the Elsewhere Chronicles, and I've got three of them. And
I've got the rest.
And I've got a bunch on hold because I just fell in love with them, seeing the shots that you guys just discussed and all. And to see that critics are comparing it to Bone, oh, my gosh. So it's, I can't resist
you,
this.
Yeah. It's,
it's
actually
really, really
much,
cool.
I can see that, actually, because it starts out very innocent,
mm-hmm.
and it gets progressively more and more dangerous as the story progresses. Very much like Bone, where
that's right.
Yeah, where you think, okay, well, they're fine, they're back home now, and then oh no, there's another complication. And when I said there's a lot of death, but it's done in a very tasteful way, and the way the characters, well, it's not gratuitous. It's not, nobody comes in with a machine gun and just mows people down. It's like when a character dies, the death has a consequence and a meaning,
yeah,
right? And it's
and
not.
And a purpose, yes.
Yeah, it has a purpose. And I don't mean the jumping in front of the bullet purpose. I mean that there's a part where just an animal in the story dies and you see how the characters react to that. And that's the meaning of that death, right? Yeah, it's a fantastic book, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's so good.
Well, I didn't look at it too close because I don't have volume one, and I'm going to read them in order.
I'll turn mine in today.
Well, that's
I'm
okay.
Done.
That's okay. So that's one thrilling series and result of getting to be on today.
Yeah.
You suggested I look around for some books that are produced in France or by French, and yes.
I thought you were going to bring this one because
we both
brought this one on the same day when
yes.
we were going to do a book talk on it because
exactly.
this is a fantastic book.
This is Ariel
yes.
By Emmanuel Joubert. Am I saying that right? And Marc Boutavant. And I'll tell you my favorite story. I've got bookmarked here is and it in terms of composition, it's pretty simple. It's the Operation ATM where
oh, that
Ariel
good,
and
yeah.
his dad are on the way to extract money from the bank, and it's mostly in the car with a
yeah.
little bit outside. But it's just hilarious the way that Ariel's you know like we're on an op now, you know, and what happens, and even the
it's about a little boy donkey.
Yes, little boy donkey and his life experiences, adventures,
right?
His wonderful, exuberant imagination.
He loves Thunder Horse.
Thunder Horse, yes. Wishes he could be Thunder Horse, but realizes, according to his parents, that he's more like Thunder Horse than his best horse friend at school.
Right.
So, yeah, no, I totally, totally love this book, so much that this is mine.
It's a fantastic comic. For anybody who's a fan of observational humor, Calvin and Hobbes. Anybody who loves Calvin and Hobbes would love Ariel, right?
Absolutely.
So.
And then because I was looking around in our world languages collection, I found Burkett by Francis Ducharnay. And it's a really cool book, I believe, done by a French-Canadian about a young girl whose father encourages her to experience other cultures. And as a result, if I can go to... She wears a burqa. And it shows kind of her experience at school, you know, basically under this tent. and it's really cool. There's other people in the story who are wearing their outfits, probably Catholics and so forth, nuns.
Yeah.
And this evidently has, you know, I can't resist when I start to investigate people like Bannister. It's like, all right, let's check on the web. And this has been made into some animated sequences too, which look like a lot of fun through her experiences.
The chicken thief.
I can't resist this. It's library. It's not technically a graphic novel, but oh my gosh, the way that this dimension of book is used to show the action of in this first story about a thief, chicken or fox thief, who steals a chicken, and how well Beatriz Rodriguez uses each of these long horizontal panels to convey the action, but also to share so much else that's going on in the story, all without words.
Yep.
Very, very cool.
All the dialogue happens through the characters' gestures.
Yeah.
And there is a big surprise at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
That is such a good book. Yeah, a lot of people have been talking about that one, but it's worth talking about.
And there's so many others. We have, of course, Lewis Trondheim. This is The Tiny Tyrant, and we have a lot of his adult books as well. And I do not know if I'm saying, is it Jean Svar?
Yeah, how do you say that, Bannister?
Joan Sfar or Joan Sfar, it depends.
Okay.
Joan Sfar, most of the time.
Well, I brought out Le Petit Prince, but the one I'm actually, and I've read this, and it's great, but the one I'm going to take home and read is
Vampire Loves. It's
this
really
one,
good. Have you read it yet?
No. I opened it up, and I'm like, oh, this one definitely looks like a winner.
Yeah.
And, of course, there's so many others. Captain Static. I took French many years ago and I had to learn more on the reading end, and it surprised me that I got most of the gist of it. But this is about a kid who, starts out normal, but then develops evidently in a powerful static charge, and how that changes his life. And there's a whole series of books, I think we just have some, and the author is Alain M. Bergeron, and I could go on with Tintin and all the others, but of course I brought our collection, almost our whole collection of Flight, which have a lot of your stories in it, Bannister. One of my favorites was the one about the cooking duel.
Oh yeah,
the action between the young man and woman who, you know, challenge each other who can make, you know, the better meal and first, and their race to the store to get the ingredients. Oh, it's a mushroom quiche, isn't it? Or something like that.
And
oh my
you've
God.
You've got the recipe at the end of the story as well.
Yes. And I'm going to try that. So thanks.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Oh, good. Good.
Cool.
Yeah, it's been written by my wife, and the recipe is from her too. And it's, it's a very fun story. I had a lot of fun drawing it, and it was one of the first story we did together.
Oh, fun.
Oh, cool.
Cool. Okay.
So what, we got like all eight?
Almost. Get them all. I couldn't get volume one, but.
Oh, well, Bannister's not in that one, so who cares?
Oh, okay, good.
We got the important one.
We got all of Bannister's.
Very important one.
Yes, yes.
But all of these are in the library's collection.
Yes.
So is Ariel in the library?
If it isn't, yes, it is.
Oh, good.
I believe so, because I think I had the library's copy the day I whipped it out, and you know, you're like, have you read this? And I went,
So all of these books will be in the show notes, archived at comicsaregreat.com/CAG85, and just go to comics.aadl.org, folks, to find all these amazing books. Any other ones?
You got
events.
I just wanna bring up that October 6th here at the library on Sunday, which is October 6th, 1 to 3 p.m. at the downtown library, we'll have comics artist Justin Castaneda driving over from Chicago to share some things about visual storytelling and writing from life, which it sounds like you do too, Bannister. We all do, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And he of course is the author of some books series When I Was Little. So.
And he's been a guest at Kids Read Comics.
Yes.
And a vital part of the Southeast Michigan comic scene. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, the Comics Artist Forum, if you haven't heard of it, is a free event put on every month, first Sunday of the month, where we have a guest speaker do a 20-40 minute little thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's just general time to hang out and draw with other local cartoonists, and a lot of local cartoonists come to that thing, both kids and adults.
Mm-hmm.
That's on the
fourth
floor conference room at the downtown branch of the Ann Arbor District Library. Oh cool. Mm-hmm. So October 6th.
Yeah,
we'll link to that in the show notes. So Bannister, do you have any book recommendations that you wanted to talk about?
I've got two very quickly. I will promote my friend's books. The first one is, I don't know if you see that.
Yes.
Big Bang
Cats. It's just been out in France right now. It's the Big Bang Cats. It's a story about a group of losers in high school who are making a rock band. And they've got to play hidden behind masks. So it's very funny. It's been written by my wife. Yeah.
Oh,
and,
wow.
And it's the artist is actually a young artist from Russia. She lives in Moscow, and she's very, very talented. You can find her on the net. She's named Anna Katish.
Cool.
And it's a very, very fun story. And the other one is also from a friend. It's brand new. It's not even in French yet, nor in English. It's just in Finnish, because the guy's from Finland, and he was in flight too, so you can look for him in flight as well. His name is Jipe Ahonen, and his new book is called Perkeros. I don't know if I pronounce it all right, but it's a story about a rock band as well. It's all about music today, and it's about metal, rock metal, and black magic. And it's amazing. The art inside is just crazy. It's a very big book, like 192 pages.
Wow.
And I think they are currently working on a deal for publishing it in the US very soon.
Okay. Very cool.
And it's going to be the same for Big Bang Cats anyway. So I've got no doubt you guys can read it pretty soon.
And we should say also that once again, this October, November
right.
area,
Tib and Tum Tum. Yeah, Tib and Tum Tum. The book one will be on October, and the book number two will be very shortly after, because they waited for us to do book number two before releasing them to the US market.
And this is about a little boy caveman.
And his pet dinosaur. He found a dinosaur in the wild, and it's basically the story of the first dog. I mean, he wants to have a friend, because he's all by himself. He's mocked by his friends, I mean, so-called friends. And he found the dinosaur in the wild, and he wants to bring it to the clan. But of course, the adults they don't want it. And the dinosaur is very funny. He's very, very agile and very flexible, so he can make a lot of postures. And it's it's a one-page gag at the same time. I mean, on one page, but it makes a whole story in the end of the book. So it's very funny.
Cool.
That's my novelty right now.
And then we will watch your Google Plus stream and your Facebook page to see more developments.
That's
for
right.
Exodus.
I will keep posting stuff for you to enjoy, and people to follow what I'm doing and the creative process behind all that.
It's really fun to watch. So, yeah. And if anybody's out there listening who has the rights to the Pole Position cartoon show, I'd love to see a reboot of the show as a comic. And I think Bannister would do a great job on it.
I'd be glad to give it a shot.
Well, Bannister, thank you so much for being part of this show.
Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure. Really.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that, because I would love to have you back. This was a really fun conversation. And same goes to you, Sharon.
Sure.
We'll see you again?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Promise. Mm-hmm. I'm holding you to it. Okay. Yep. All right. Well, so Bannister can be found at facebook.com/Nicholas. Nicholas with just a C, no H. N-I-C.
Yeah,
Bannister, B-A-N-N-I-S-T-A. We'll link to it in the show notes, and you can also find him on Google+. And then Sharon Iverson, we can't find her anywhere.
No.
She's invisible to the internet.
Yeah, I just come out once on a great moon, blue moon.
And then thanks to the Ann Arbor District Library for putting the show on every 2 weeks. Matt in the control room, and Eric, who's monitoring the chat, and then Tom, who helps out in the technical direction of the show. And thanks to the Ann Arbor District Library for letting me do this thing in your facilities. This show will be archived at comicsaregreat.com/CAG85. You can listen to an audio version of the show. You can watch a video of the show on YouTube. It's also on Stitcher if you want to stream it on your mobile device. Any place where you can get audio, you can probably find this show. So thanks again, everybody, for listening and watching. Until next time, I have been Jersey Droz of comicsaregreat.com and Jersey on Twitter. Okay, bye.